Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good afternoon, evening, morning, whenever it is that you're listening to this podcast. Welcome back to another edition of Tomahawk Nation's Hoops Dedicated Podcast. I am your host, Matt Minnick, as always joined by Michael Rogner here on the Sunday after Thanksgiving. Michael, did you enjoy a nice Thanksgiving?
I did. We had some traditional lobster rolls for all the Rogners lost at sea, you know, honored over the years. So it was good.
Nothing says America like lobster rolls.
Right.
we had my probably one of my favorite. I don't know if a lot of people make this or not. My mother-in-law does a really good. It's like a pineapple dish that you just basically have cheddar cheese all over. It's sort of a warmed pineapple cheddar cheese dish that always is a hit around the Thanksgiving and holiday time. So that's a good one. And then we had the smorgasbord of meats, the hams, the turkeys, the duck. It was a big crowd at the in-laws' house this year.
Yeah, I might have to try that pineapple thing. That sounds good.
Oh, maybe I'll get, I don't know if there's more to it than that, if there's some butter or something else in there too, but I'll maybe see if I can get a recipe or if it truly is just pineapple and cheddar cheese. So a lot of other stuff's happened since besides feasting on food, there's been a feast of hoops and football too. And you know, before we get into maybe some of the hoops talk, I think it's just at least noteworthy that another Florida State football season has come and gone. I was hoping this year I'd set aside some money and some time to go to a bowl game, and it isn't going to happen because of a loss against Florida where it looked like maybe there were chances to win but you know, the team didn't pull it out. But I think there has certainly been some improvements made this year that from, you know, we can see the coaching staff has things on the right track. Michael, I know you've watched most of the football games. Do you have any thoughts on FSU's football season this year?
Yeah, I used to, you know, live and die by football games, and I'd get, you know, terribly upset if we lost a game like that. But something has changed in the last several years that has enabled me to just be a little more zen about these things. And watching us whiff the onside kick at the end was just
the old Charlie Brown, the old Charlie Brown kick. Yeah,
that was just a beautiful way to kind of sum up the state of Florida State football. But you mentioned that Florida State is on track, and it certainly feels that way to me. You know, we kind of probably have to hit another home run in the transfer portal. But if we get a good class, then, you know, suddenly you've got a bunch of talented young guys that Norvell targeted, you know, and we
right,
can start,
for his system. Start,
yeah, start building that team, you know, by position groups, as opposed to just a bunch of guys that just happen to, you know, commit to Florida State and we figure out what to do with them.
Yeah. I mean, since this is a basketball podcast and a Florida State one at that, you know, I was preparing for this for our little chat today, and it struck me that the situation of Florida State's football program is perhaps not that dissimilar from the state of the program that Hamilton inherited from Steve Robinson. And, you know, this is, we're talking two decades ago, but when, you know, for folks who maybe don't know, Florida State was the worst basketball program in the ACC when Leonard Hamilton took it over, and one of the probably five worst, you know, major conference programs in the country. And to your point, Michael, at that stage, recruiting meant I just need bodies to be able to play basketball games. And I mean, they were coming off years where they were losing to teams like American University. And it really was, you know, some of the early years, there were teams that had a guy like Tim Pickett, who maybe is the football's version, you know, the basketball's version of Jordan Travis, just sort of lightning and made things happen. Al Thornton, maybe you could say was like a Jermaine Johnson or something that just kind of took over games, but the teams didn't know how to win as the teams were really just figuring out how to be a winning program. And it wasn't until Hamilton got to a point that he could actually start to recruit guys to fit positions within a system, as opposed to just, I need somebody who wants to play for my team. Does any of this make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can see in Hamilton's first team, like he's trying to build a roster that, you know, would probably look similar to today. You know, I mean, he had Trevor Harvey, if anybody remembers that guy, you get an award, but he was 6'11", you know, 230, he's big, you know, big body in the middle, and then, you know, surround him by a bunch of athletic guys. And, you know, luckily he had Tim Pickett, who could, you know, was worth a few wins by himself, but right.
Luckily we have Jordan Travis.
Yeah, exactly. And it's guys who just kind of fit, but don't really, you know, and you're rolling Adam Wolaskowski off the bench, you know, and just Andrew Wilson and these guys who, you know, were, you know, okay players, but it's just not really fitting into the system. And the other part is the cultural side of things, you know. Mm. They talk about the culture of FSU basketball now. And since Ham has been able to cast a wider net, you can really dial down on the intangibles, which is what those early teams were missing. You know, there were some guys on there who would never play for Florida State now, not because of what they did on the basketball court, but because of what they did off the basketball court.
Yeah, and they just didn't always finish games either. I mean, there were just a lot of years where we were on the bubble. We struggled to win away from home. I mean, I know the football team did win a road game, I think, this year against Boston College, but we certainly were a better home team than we were on the road. I think there was a couple back-to-back years where we went 0-8 in the ACC on the road in some of those early Hamilton years. We would pull an upset or two at home, but we didn't have consistent play, and we didn't have consistent closing time play. And a lot of that, I do think, goes back to the culture. And you see now, I mean, what didn't FSU basketball just set an all-time NCAA record for most consecutive overtime wins at 12?
Yeah, 12 in a row.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think it's a true testament to a guy being given time to get his guys, get his system, and lay a bit of a foundation that, to your point, then allowed him to cast a bit of a wider net and start to be a little pickier about not just the players and their player skill sets that they were bringing in, but also their cultural and personality skill sets that they were bringing to the team.
Yeah, and if you look at coaches today, they don't get time. I mean, there's a graphic yesterday during the game of there's been like five coaches, football coaches that have been fired in, you know, the first 3 years of their contract or something like that, you know, and Hamilton was given plenty of time. You know, it took them 7 years to get to the tournament. And you just kind of wonder if that's going to happen, you know, what happened these days. And with football, there's so much more of a focus on football because of the money involved that, you know, you wonder how much time guys are going to get. And, you know, Coach Norvell's in his second year. He's appears to be moving in the right direction. But if we don't show improvement next year, then, you know, it's a good thing Florida State doesn't have a ton of money, because they'd probably, you know, start thinking right about moving on. And it's, you know, it's this weird situation for the football team where we kind of have to give the guy time, and he inherited a total shit show. So,
yeah,
you know, he deserves to have some time. I don't know if 7 years is, you know, is reasonable, but, you know, back in the day, in terms of basketball, it was.
And I'll say this, to be fair, I think, you know, Hamilton had probably two teams in the first 5 years that were NCAA tournament quality. You know, fewer teams made the tournament back then. They still relied on an outdated metric of the RPI. I think that if the NCAA tournament selection criteria as of 2021 was used in 2006. That team makes the NCAA tournament. And so I think that as someone who is a season ticket holder to the football games and donates money to the program and stuff, I think you're right. I mean, the football team took a step forward this year. This year made me feel like that year with the basketball program when we were an NIT level team with Tim Pickett and Nate Johnson and like we won some games that, you know, hey, it's like, hey, it's exciting again. We weren't going 8 or 9 and 20 or whatever for the season. It was exciting to go to some games again. And I think next year, you know, really, I mean, it's the same. It's not that different of a story. What did Hamilton do? He hit the transfer portal. We got Tony Douglas, right? Like transfer from Auburn, had to rely on some JUCO transfers. And he had that one recruiting class with Chris Singleton and Dulkies and some others that kind of set things over the top. You know, I'm told by we've got a podcast, you know, go over and listen to the Three Stars, right? That the football recruiting podcast told we have a pretty good recruiting class. And maybe that's the class that can be the Chris Singleton class for Hamilton. You got to see continued improvement on the field, but I feel like as long as they build an offense that caters to Jordan Travis and the skill set that he has, at a minimum, I'll feel like, you know, at least it's exciting to go to games again, and we have a chance every time that I walk into a game in Doak Campbell.
Yeah, who could forget the Dulkies game, you know, against North Carolina? And that was,
right,
you know, that was that class, the Luke Locks, the pass to Snare to was that beating Duke? That,
in Cameron, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Carl White with the screen, the drag screen at midcourt.
Yeah. Those were fun games. And, you know, you mentioned the Tony team from 2006-07 when he broke his hand. That team's probably a 5 seed, you know, using modern
metrics.
Criteria, yeah. So.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that team was 9-7 in a good ACC and was a top 25 or 30 basketball team on all the advanced metrics. So, yeah, that, like you said, that's a 5 or a 6 seed and someone that no one wants to play in March. And you know that, hey, if Florida State can make a bowl game that next year, I think that's like another step in the right direction. You know, that's making the NIT, I suppose. All right. Well, I'm sure you can find other podcasts to listen to football talk. But it struck me watching the game yesterday that it seemed like maybe Norvell was having his early Hamilton era Tim Pickett team of let's just get some excitement back in the stands. And I think he accomplished that this year. A lot has happened on the hard court since we last spoke as well, in addition to the loss to UF on the gridiron. Let me just run through I think the last time we spoke, we were previewing the Penn and Florida games. And those, we were correct about the problem for UF. Colin Castleton, I think we underestimated just how big of a problem he was going to be for us. And to be quite honest, Mike White looks like he has his toughest and most physical team that he's had in his tenure. So it started off the season with a win and a loss, 71-55 loss on the road at UF. And now Florida State's rattled off 4 consecutive victories, although of varying degree of quality, 59-54 at home over Tulane, a 73-45 thrashing of Loyola Marymount on a neutral court in Jacksonville, followed up by an 81-58 demolition of Missouri the next night in Jacksonville, and then came home 2 days later and won a overtime game against Boston University that I don't feel like it should have ever gone to overtime, but nonetheless, the Seminoles pulled it out 81-80, and in March, all you need is close wins. It doesn't matter. Sometimes it doesn't matter. Just keep winning. So that's where we stand. Things are at 5-1 after maybe the first, I don't know, quarter to fifth of the season. Michael, do you have any high-level trends or takeaways from these first 6 games?
Yeah, I think the take home for me is that the team is just wildly inconsistent at this point. We've played 3 really, really, really good games, and we've played 3 games where we kind of laid an egg, you know, Florida, Tulane, and BU, you know, get blown out at Florida in the final 10 minutes, barely beat Tulane, barely beat BU. you know, those are teams that we should be rolling. And then on, you know, on the flip side, that game against Loyola Marymount was one of the best games that Florida State has played. And, you know, and if it matches up with, yeah, with the best games from last season, like when we beat NC State by like 30 and Virginia by 20. You know, Loyola Marymount's a good team. And Missouri, we totally, you know, curb stomped them. And then the opener against Penn, you know, was the same kind of way. It was just, I think even the coaches were a little surprised by how well we handled Penn. So we've got a lot of new faces. You know, I don't want to call it a young team because some of them are transfers, you know, and but, you know, youngish. And but the main part is that, you know, trying to integrate these new guys into the system is, you know, going to be a challenge. And let's hope that come March, we're playing more like we did against Loyola Marymount than we did about how we did against BU.
Yeah, the West Coast Conference is a good league most years, but this year, if folks haven't paid attention, the West Coast Conference, I mean, honestly, Michael, you're out there in California, but I mean, is it silly to say that four teams from the West Coast Conference could make the NCAA tournament?
Absolutely. And you know, if it were not for
absolutely Pepperdine, silly or not, or possible.
Oh, no, that's yeah. Totally. I think probable at this point. I mean, yeah. the top four teams are, I think 26-2.
Okay.
You know, with and you know, have really good wins over lots of other West Coast teams from major conferences. So, you know, it's not a stretch. I think Loyola Marymount will probably, you know, kind of be on the outside looking in out of that conference, but they're going to get plenty of opportunities to play really good teams. And at the end of the season, that win against Loyola Marymount's going to look pretty good.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think especially on a neutral court, that's a quad two win in my mind. Something would have to go drastically wrong for their season. And hey, I suppose there's the outside chance that they overachieve and that sneaks into quad one. But it feels like a good quad two win. And then yeah, like, and I know there were tired legs, and I know that there were some difficult circumstances with the tragic passing of Raekwon Evans' brother, and so he didn't play. But you know, the Boston University game was just a shit show, really. I mean, we never really felt like in control. That you looked at the stats and you'd think, how is this only a 6 or 7 point game? Florida State had fewer turnover percent, you know, higher rebound percent, higher assist percent, generating a lot of turnovers, and yet it was a 6 or 8 point game. And we saw the ending where Boston hit a couple of deep threes to send it to OT. What is that? So you're just, from what I hear from you though, is that just seems to be the hallmark of a team that has two or three guys who have played with each other for 3 years, and they're trying to get three or four other guys who have played with each other for 3 weeks on the same page. Like, it just seems like Polite and Osborne are like anticipating a player being somewhere where they're not. And at the same time, then it just causes general standing around. Maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. And that's where Raekwon Evans is so important, because he, you know, he is more used to having the ball in his hands. And when we turn to Polite to play point guard, it's just not going to be all that successful. And Jalen Worley has had his moments, but he clearly, you know, does not understand the offense at this point. He's working on it, and I still think that he's going to be, you know, a great Florida State player over the years. But it's going to take him a while to get there. And, you know, if you look at the BU game, you know, Malik Osborne plays 6 minutes in the first half, and then he never comes out in the second half until there's like 10 seconds left in overtime. And Polite, I believe, played all but 1 minute in the second half. And so it kind of felt to me that Ham sort of abandoned his own principles of, you know, substitute early and often and constantly to keep fresh legs. And if you look at what BU was able to do down the stretch, you know, they started picking us apart with back cuts and, you know, all the plays that tired defenders aren't able to defend. You know, BU was just hitting, you know, time and time again, and we couldn't get stops. And it's, you know, it's the exact opposite of the Tulane game. The Tulane game was our defense was fine, but our offense was just god awful. And then, you know, this game, our offense was totally fine, and the defense was, you know, the one falling apart.
Well, and part of the thing, yeah, the BU game, they just could not get stops. Florida State was up 6 or 7 the whole half and could not get stops. The Tulane game, you know, and that's a game where we did have Raekwon Evans. He was not good in that game. He had, well, okay, so he set a career high with 4 blocks. He also had 4 turnovers and 1 for 6 shooting. I don't think it helped that, you know, Caleb Mills in that game, that was the game in which it there was a point in time in the second half. I leaned over to Brett Nevitt, I think, and noted that Caleb Mills had attempted more shots than Malik Osborne, Anthony Polite, Wyatt Wilkes, and I believe Cameron Fletcher combined. And he only made 5. So when you go 5 of 15 and also dribble the ball a lot, you know, yeah, I think the offense is going to struggle. Credit the team. And this maybe goes back to the first part of our podcast. Credit the culture of the team for finding ways to win games like Tulane and for finding ways to win games like Boston University. And I know it's very easy to say, oh, well, that's BU and that's Tulane. And you know what? It was also Jacksonville State for the football team that they lost. So credit the culture of the team for finding ways to win games. You have to do that in March. You do not have your A game or even B plus game 6 straight games. Maybe except for that one year Villanova just beat the crap out of everybody or UNLV. But it does seem concerning that they just haven't been able to put it all together in some games. And then the next game, they turn around and blow the doors off a solid Loyola Marymount team. But again, maybe that's just the inconsistency that they're fighting through right now.
Yeah. And I think if they can just get on the same page, then that'll enable the 3 experienced guys to be more consistent. And then if you get good contributions from like 2 of the new guys, you know, then you're going to be competitive in all the games. If we're relying on Caleb Mills to just dribble through possessions and score all the time, then, you know, we're not going to be successful. It's got to be back to, you know, moving the ball rapidly with passes, around the perimeter, sort of probing for that opening, and then, you know, get in, get a shot, get the offensive rebound or whatever. And right now the offense is just, it's still trying to feel out like what it is that they're supposed to be doing. And our talent level against BU enabled us to just kind of score when we needed to, but the actual offense, you know, maybe wasn't the half court offense, maybe, you know, probably wasn't that good.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's talk about maybe a couple of things that the team has been doing consistently well. They're turning teams over 27% of their possessions, and we're only 6 games in. I'm sure that number is going to come down. That would destroy the best mark under Hamilton, if they kept that up. I think I didn't write every season. I think 24.1% is the best. I want to say back in one of those Chris Singleton days, 24.1 or 23.9 or something like that, turning teams over. Problem is, we also turned the ball over about 23.9% of the possessions that year. I want to say maybe like 2010 or something. We are at our best. Like, I feel like we are to the point in this 6 games in, it is pretty clear that if we face a team who is unable to take care of the basketball and sort of get sped up and either makes the poor choice or is sort of sucked into a game that is up tempo and somewhat sloppy, they might get run off the court against this team because we are turning teams over a ton and scoring well in transition when we do. And the other thing we're doing well is offensive rebounding. You mentioned, I'd love to see it. You know, our best offense, and it won us the game against BU in overtime, our best offense might be get a shot up early in the shot clock and crash the offensive glass. We're 27th in the country at offensive rebounding percentage. Matt Cleveland won it on an offensive rebound in the BU game. And we also were staying in it in the UF game earlier on with some of the offensive rebounding. So those are some 2 things that I've at least seen we're doing consistently well. Do you think both or one of those can be, you know, moderately maintained through the rest of the year?
We'll see about the turnover thing. I mean, that this team is long. They're jumping passing lanes. It's gonna stay high all year. It's one of those stats that's not going to be consistent. You know, some games you're going to turn teams over a bunch. They're going to miss shots. We're going to have plenty of opportunities to run, and we're just going to run teams out of the gym because, you know, our transition offense is pretty much at a March level right now. I mean, it's tough to stop. I would like to see Florida State on made buckets try to push the ball a little faster. You know, we tend to just kind of walk over, pick up the rebound, throw it in, dribble it up, you know, and that's not playing to the probably to the strengths of this team. So that's one thing that I would like to see tweaked. And then, you know, you hit it on the head with the offensive rebounding. It's just get a shot up. We'd so many times, you know, you Anthony Polite or Evans or somebody just passes up a wide open three. We pass it around for 10 more seconds and turn the ball over. And it's just that's not good. It's not a good philosophy. We need to have guys with less indecision, you know, taking more shots. And I'd be happy with that.
Yeah. I mean, it's third or fourth time out of the last 5 years, fourth out of the last five, we're the tallest team in the country. I know that we've actually played small a bit more than in past years, but we are, and we're not just tall, we're long and we're athletic. Take the shot, take the shot and get guys like Matt Cleveland, Malik Osborne, even Anthony Polite, get on the offensive glass, and do some work there. You talk about pushing after makes. That's been actually, I haven't watched film of the two games that were in Jacksonville, but that's been my maybe pleasant surprise with Jalen Worley. I feel like he's now, sometimes he's over dribbled a bit and he needs to learn that it's not high school, and you pushing pace actually can work really well by passing up the court. But I think he's done a better job maybe than some of the others of trying to get us into our offense earlier in the shot clock, as opposed to exploring what's at the top of the key for a little while.
Yeah. And in Trent's final year, we had a lot of possessions where the other team would score and we would get a layup, you know, just because, you know, he was great at just pushing the pace. And, you know, Evans is not going to be that guy, but Worley, like, I agree with you. He tends to dribble into traffic too much, which is problematic, but he'll figure that out.
That's a freshman thing.
Yeah. It's kind of totally
it's a non-top five recruit freshman thing, right?
Yeah, right.
Sorry, he's not Paolo Banchero.
Yeah. Yeah. Paolo Banchero can dribble into traffic and be just fine.
Yeah. Speaking of maybe the, let me say one more thing on Worley and then we'll open it up to the rest of the newcomers. I'm actually, you know, so I was a student athlete in college, and I'm looking forward to this Lipscomb to maybe Boston College set here of four games. I think we've got Lipscomb, UCF, North Florida, and then like a Boston College team. Those guys aren't going to be going to class during that time. It'll be the first time this year as the full team that they're able to practice most of the day, not all of it affirmed like NCAA hours, but, you know, watching some film, getting in the gym, helping each other out, you know? And so I'm actually interested. I think you could see by the Wake Forest game, for example, in early January, I think you could see a Jalen Worley who has taken some steps forward after having four games over all against manageable competition over the time period when he is not studying for college level classes. Speaking of the rest of the newcomers, I'm curious, two guys who have really surprised me with the level of contributions we're seeing from them in the first six games of their first year on campus are John Butler and Cameron Fletcher. John Butler is flashing really his entire skill set. So in each of the six games, we've seen some block shots from him. We've seen some made threes. We've seen him put it on the deck. We've seen him be effective as a rebounder and a passer. Even he shows a knack of passing over the, using his height and length to pass over the top of the defense. And then Cameron Fletcher just has incredible defensive instincts. Talk about jumping passing lanes. He really has made an impact on the defensive side, and he's a better 3-point shooter than I thought maybe too. I mean, small sample size, but he's 6 of 14. Did you expect either of these two guys to be giving us the game by game impact this first year that they've had?
Well, I knew Butler was going to be good, and I you know, if he stayed all 4 years, like he's like a jersey in the rafters kind of recruit. He's not going to be here 4 years, but you know, he's that good. And you know, there was talk of redshirting him, you know, and on the message boards just because he's so thin, and you know, that's just not going to happen. I would like to see him be a little more aggressive on the offensive end. You know, he's a total unicorn and impossible to guard, and he shot the ball really well, including like, you know, 18 foot, you know, one dribble jump shots, you know, and which is, you know, an NBA shot. And with Cameron Fletcher, I did not expect him to have this kind of an impact. You know, I was hoping that he could just, you know, spend the year getting accustomed to the culture and kind of figuring out, but he takes over for stretches of a game, and it's impressive. He's a, you know, we knew he was a high level athlete, but I did not know that he would be able to pick up, you know, like defensive nuances so quickly. And, you know, he's got a grown man's body, and he's that piece that I think that some of our past teams have kind of missed. You know, you want a guy out there who's going to bully people. You know, you want a guy out there who's going to get in people's faces. And, you know, Fletcher seems to be that guy. He fouls too much. He's got to figure that out. But other than that, he's been great.
Yeah, Fletcher, among the people who play at least a quarter of our minutes, Fletcher is the second best offensive rebounder on the team so far. And on top of that, like you said, he bullies people on defense. And he does foul. And yeah. In a big game, that would be a problem. But right now I almost like to see some aggressiveness from a young kid that's out there and just hungry to make a difference. He's on the court. And the 3-point shooting has been really, I mean, I already said it, 6-14, but that allows him, I think, to not just be someone who can only spend small amount of minutes on. I mean, he can play both ways. And right now, the more he puts that on film, even if he goes into a little bit of a funk, even if 6-14 turns into 8-20 or 8-22, there's film of him burying, you know, threes from the wing in the corner, and opponents are going to have to respect that when he's in the game, which is going to open up more shots for some of our slashers, like a Matt Cleveland, who does not appear right now to have a comfortable 3-point shot. He's very comfortable off the dribble in the mid range, but that will be opened up the more that people like Fletcher can put film on tape of making threes. Butler, you were higher on him for this season than I was. I think we both are very intrigued by his long-term skill set. I think that the way the NBA game is going, he seems like a great fit for the modern NBA game. I just was concerned at how he was going to be able to, frankly, defend this year with his strength. He seems to have better functional strength than his body would appear to have just by looks. And he really can get to his spots on offense. It's concerning that he has taken a grand total of 0 free throws. Maybe that's just him starting to feel his way out in an offense where he's, you know, oftentimes fourth or fifth option on the court. But he seems like someone that's going to make a difference for us all season long.
Yeah, and you kind of have to think of him as like a really tall Wyatt Wilkes. You know, I mean, he's out there taking jump shots. He's not driving to the basket. And he'll develop that part of his game, but you know, for now he's a jump shooter, and you know, hopefully we can get him a little more involved in transition. You know, I think that's where he can probably, you know, take advantage of his size to get to the line. And on defense, he's, you know, he's tasked with guarding, you know, 1-5, and there are smaller guards who are going to blow right by him. But he's shown the ability to recover, and he's just his arms are like 9 feet long, so he just. Even if he's behind them, you know, he's still impacting their shot and impacting their thought process, and you know, just causing all kinds of trouble. He's a great guy to have as a secondary defender. You know, just rotating over and you know, blocking shots, and it's been impressive to watch on both ends of the floor.
Yeah, he's also fouling a bit too much. He's right at about 5 fouls called per 40, but although I think given his role, you know, if he's giving you 2 to 3 blocks a game, I don't know, maybe I'll take that. I'd like to see that closer to 4 fouls called per 40 as opposed to 5. But again, freshmen are going to freshmen. The one newcomer that we've spent some time on, Worley, we've spent some time on Mills. I'll note that we don't know the severity of it, but Naheem McLeod stepped on a basketball prior to the Boston University game and had his foot in a boot for that game immediately. So whether it's sprained, broken, I would imagine that he doesn't play for a month plus, just if I had to guess, just given the way that those things tend to go at Florida State. Depending on how our season goes, wouldn't be surprised if he is shut down for the rest of the year, since he's only played in 4 games and would still qualify for a redshirt. But, you know, we haven't talked a ton about Matthew Cleveland. He maybe had his Patrick Williams game when Patrick Williams sort of took over late against Western Carolina a couple years ago and sort of turned what would have been an ugly home loss into a late win. But Matthew Cleveland, he is clearly comfortable slashing to the rim and hitting those floaters in the lane. His body control is excellent. He's been good on defense. He is, you know, maybe not jumped quite as many passing lanes as I would expect, but he's able to alter some shots and get on the defensive glass and start the fast break. Are you expecting Matthew Cleveland to maybe take the next step up into starter even, or like, is that BU game a sign of things to come for him?
Yeah, I think back to, was it Michael Snair who played about the first half of his freshman season coming off the bench and mm-hmm. then, you know, got inserted into the starting lineup for the rest of his career. And Cleveland seems to be on that same, you know, sort of trajectory. I did really appreciate how emotional he was after he made that shot. You know, that just shows that somebody has to win and, you know, has that drive. And that's the kind of guys that you want out on the court, is guys who take winning and losing extremely seriously, like way too seriously than probably is good for you. But, you know, that's what you want to see. And right now his mid-range game he's NBA ready in the mid-range. The rest of his game needs a lot of work, but he has obviously the tools to do it. He's a 5-star for a reason, and you watch him move on the court and it's, you know, it's pretty clear that he's a different type of dude than, you know, probably a lot of the guys who are guarding him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's 6 of 12 from the free throw line. I would like, it's a double-edged sword. I would like him to get to the free throw line more, because I would always like for us to be drawing fouls. His shot clearly is a work in progress there. He sort of pushes the ball. He doesn't really have, you know, you look at John Butler and it's just this beautiful, you know, hand in the cookie jar rotation on it and stuff. And Cleveland's doing a little bit of pushing there. Doesn't look comfortable. He's at the right school. Stan Jones has proven consistently as recently as last year, when Scotty Barnes also went from uncomfortable at the free throw line to at least serviceable by the end of the season. And frankly, that was a big part of him moving up draft boards. So I think he's at the right school. I would imagine that Cleveland is up above 60-65% from the free throw line later in the season, which will probably make him more apt to feel comfortable getting there. I don't know that we're going to see much improvements from the 3-point line this year. If by chance he stays for a second year, perhaps that's a weapon he adds to his arsenal. Right now, he seems clearly at his best in that NBA mid-range game, which I think, given the shooters of Polite, Evans, if he'll actually take shots from the perimeter, Wilkes, Butler, Fletcher, Osborne, all those guys can bang down some threes. So I don't know that we need that from Matthew Cleveland. I do think that we will need his aggressiveness and for him to become, like you said, maybe like inserted into the starting lineup or at least playing starters minutes probably by early January.
Yeah. And you know, if he's able to do that, that's obviously a good sign. You brought up a good point about the 3-point, you know, his game kind of opens up 3-pointers for other people. And Ham has consistently said that, you know, this might be his best 3-point shooting team. He said the same thing last year. And it was within a fraction of a percentage point of actually being true. So I think that, you know, to date we've shot 37.6 or 38% from
37.6, which is identical to our season percentage from last year. 37.6.
And it's felt like we've just missed so many shots that typically make, like, Polite. I've never seen him miss shots like that he's missing now. And you got to figure that's going to change. And then, you know, Wilkes has had some wide open threes that, you know, he's always been streaky, but those are shots that he knocks down. And so if Butler, guys like Butler and Fletcher and Osborne can continue to shoot at a high level, you know, I think that Ham could be right and we could have a really good 3-point shooting team. You know, Osborne is obviously not going to shoot 64% for the season, but he looks totally comfortable just dribbling into a three.
Yeah, I'll go on record right now and saying that I do think that we finish with the highest 3-point shooting percentage in Hamilton's tenure, maybe eking up above 38%. I think that Osborne and Fletcher will probably regress a little bit to the mean, but neither guy are high volume, so that's not going to move the needle as much as Polite and Wilkes and probably even a Caleb Mills progressing. I think they each – well, Polite, I think, will bust out here with like a 5-for-7 game pretty soon. And then Mills and Wyatt, I think, will both get up into that 36-37% range. So, yeah, I will go on record now and say that assuming a guy like Cleveland doesn't start jacking up 4 threes a game, we should finish at or setting a new record or just at the record of best 3-point shooting team in Hamilton's tenure. All right. Any other things you want to say real quick on this first 6 games of the season before we take a break and move into Purdue and Syracuse?
Tenor Ingham took a 3. That was fun. It actually looked pretty good. It kind of went in and out. So I don't know if that's something that he's going to be doing more of this year or if that was just a total mind fart and he just chucked one up thinking he was in practice.
We need him to get going though. I'll say that we need him to be, he's playing 18% of our total minutes. We need that to be closer to 30. I think he'd have made a difference against Castleton and UF.
Yeah. And especially considering, you know, we've got some games coming up with some, you know, pretty skilled big men and we absolutely need him to be able to play, you know, 18 minutes or whatever a game.
Yeah. So maybe that's a note for the future, for a future episode to check in on how Tenor is doing. I think he is someone who could take our defense up another level. Okay, so let's take a break then, and we will come back and spend just the rest of the time on our upcoming 2 games, both of which are against some talented competition. All right, back here with Michael Rogner. We spent the first half hour or so, maybe 35 minutes, on comparing the Florida State basketball program to the state of things with the football program and sort of like a look back at where things were when Hamilton first came compared to with Norvell's era here. And then sort of just reviewing general notes, thoughts, trends, reflections on the 5-1 start for your Florida State Seminoles on the hard court. Let's look at the upcoming 2 games. So they played 3 games in 4 days with Loyola Marymount, Missouri, and Boston. They then take 6 days off for the holiday and travel up to West Lafayette, Indiana, in the ACC Big Ten Classic or Challenge, I believe it's called, to take on what Michael might be the best basketball team in the country. I'm sure Gonzaga and Duke would say something about that, and probably Kansas fans as well. But, you know, Purdue looks as good as anybody else right now. And they are they typically have a very nice home environment. So, I don't know. I'm not feeling all that enthusiastic about our chances against Purdue, but tell me why I should be optimistic maybe, or no, just keep the expectations low.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, you're kind of painting me into a corner to give you a reason to be optimistic, and I don't have a lot. I think the odds of losing this game by 20 plus are probably greater than the odds of winning it. Purdue is just, their offense is unbelievable. And, you know, Florida State's defense kind of predicates itself on taking away the things that other teams do well. And I just don't know that you know, the defense is ready for, you know, what's coming on Tuesday night. They don't force turnovers, so maybe we'll be able to actually play a clean game and be able to stick around, you know, on offense. But that game the other night with Duke and Gonzaga, you saw two teams that, you know, were really playing at a high level, and it was a close game all the way. And, you know, obviously we want this, you know, Florida State Purdue game to be the same level, but I just, you know, question whether Florida State's really ready for this.
Well, and that game was played on a neutral court in Las Vegas, 50-50 stands, both teams relatively new to the sight lines. Let me hit you. Here's Purdue's offense this year, Michael. They scored 96, 92, 96, 93, 80 in a 60 possession game against a top 10 Villanova team. So that's so pretty darn efficient. And then 97. They are eighth in the country. We were talking about Florida State shooting pretty well, 37, 38% from three. They're eighth in the country at 43.5% shooting from three as a team. And when they miss, they are fourth in the country, grabbing over 41% of the available offensive rebounds. Michael, we don't necessarily do well on the defensive glass, and we don't oftentimes prevent teams from getting open threes. You combine that with the fact that they have not one, but two big men who are rebounding over 20%. They're sixth and seventh in the country offensive rebounding, and they, one of them is shooting 75% on the year, and the other is shooting 68% from two on the year. I don't understand how we're going to slow them down short of winning the 3-point lottery.
Yeah, they have obviously, you know, some weapons on offense, but that combo of Zach Edey and Trevion Williams in the middle is just unbelievable. Zach Edey's 7'4". He's made 75% of his shots on the season. He's a, you know, he doesn't move as well as Ngom, but we're clearly going to need Ngom to be ready to play this game. And then they're rolling Trevion Williams off the bench, and he was a preseason all
Big Ten. Right. He's a senior all Big Ten player.
Yeah. And he is just, you know, lights out when he comes in, and he's very different from Edey. He's smaller. He's about 6'10", but he's a bull and impossible to guard. And then they have Jaden Ivey, who he's sophomore, and I haven't been checking the NBA draft boards or anything, but I can't imagine that he won't be, you know, a lottery pick at the end of the season. And it's not based strictly on potential. Like, he's a fully formed player at 19 or 20 or however old he is. And then they surround those guys with a bunch of guys who can hit threes. So it's a problem.
Yeah. Edey is, I mean, if you imagine Michael Ojo, 7'4", 295, maybe not quite as like chiseled cut, but just except for the fact that you give him outstanding basketball skill, right? And the ability to post, I mean, like you said, he's hitting 75% of his, he's 39 of 52 on the season, and he's knocking down 85% of his free throws. He's 28 for 33 from the free throw line. This guy's 7'4", 295. I guess there's sometimes a school of thought of, you actually go so counterintuitive that you play guys like Malik or even like a Matthew Cleveland, who just, you have to be prepared to take it right into his chest and draw the foul. Trevion Williams is getting called for over five fouls per 40. So you can get some of these guys into foul trouble. If you are decisive and dribble with a purpose and take it right into the chest, but you better be prepared to finish through contact. Cause if you go up weak, that is getting swatted back, and you are not getting the call in Purdue's house.
Yeah, they also have talking about getting swatted, they have a 6'10 guy who plays on the perimeter. So they have plenty of guys who can block shots. They're top 20 in the country at blocking shots. And then the one place that we could potentially give them trouble is that, you know, Florida State plays a different style of defense than basically any other team in the country. And Zach Edey and Trevion Williams are not used to to being fronted, you know, when they're calling for the ball in the post. So it's going to be, or it could be, you know, more challenging to get those guys involved in the half court offense, but it's going to have to be one of those games where it seems like Florida State has six defenders on the floor and it's everybody flying around, everybody in sync. If we get out of sync, it's a layup or an open three.
Yeah. I'm not confident. I think we lose by double digits. I think if you tell me, well, Matt, envision a game in which Florida State has a chance with 3 minutes to go, you got to win the 3-point lottery and we got to hit some early, right? You have to hit some early to put a little pressure on the other team. They need to shoot 35% as opposed to 45%. And one of the two bigs needs to get in foul trouble. And a guy that I feel like could maybe make some of that happen is Cameron Fletcher. I think he can hit a shot or two early. I think that he's able to, let's say we get a couple steals, we're front in the post, couple deflections, steals. That's a great way to get a big man in trouble. You know, you go into the body in transition or as the secondary trailer when there's still a little bit of a scramble and they haven't had a chance to set their defense yet. You know, that could happen. And again, you sort of take the fight to, you do what Florida did to us and take the fight to them. And, you know, maybe you get a team that quite honestly hasn't been in a close game. Like they haven't really been pressured that much. Maybe you get a team back on their heels and that's a possibility. But if we start a little slow and we're over helping on those bigs down underneath, and leading guys like Sasha Stefanovic open. I mean, we're talking about a dude who's hit, he's already had three games this year of four or more threes, right? He was 5 for 6, 5 for 11, 4 for 8. Last year he had several games with five, even a 6-3-point game. So you just can't overhelp on, I mean, you got to play it straight and let's see if the ball goes in. But I don't know. I say we move on to Syracuse, quite honestly, because this feels like 92 to maybe 78 Purdue.
Yeah, I think if we win, I'll take Anthony Polite as the guy who has the game. Like he in the tournament last year, he had some crazy game against Colorado, and you know, we'll see something like that if Florida State is able to pull the upset.
Yeah. Okay. So we are both feeling like the record is headed to 5-2 against Purdue here coming up. Why don't we switch over to Syracuse, which quite honestly is a much more important game. So we play Purdue on Tuesday. We get Syracuse on Saturday. Syracuse, by the way, coming off a loss to Auburn on a neutral court. They play Indiana on Tuesday. So we play Purdue. They get the other Big Ten team in Indiana. And then they travel down to Florida State. And with all due respect to Purdue, I mean, losing a non-conference game on the road is nothing to the tournament committee. I mean, that just looks like you did what you were supposed to do. If we were to pull the upset, you can go ahead and put us down for a 4 seed right now. The Syracuse game, both with it being a home game and opening up conference play, you did not want to start 0-1 in conference play. That game certainly of more importance, and one in which I think that unless we just have one of those 0-for nights from three, I think that I feel pretty good about our ability to attack this Syracuse team.
Yeah, we've been pretty successful against, you know, Boeheim zone in the past, so the coaches very clearly know how to attack it. Will the new guys be able to pick that up? And if just a few days of practice, hopefully we've already been working on it, because as you mentioned, this game is more important. Syracuse now has three Boeheim, so they've got the coach and Buddy, and then they added Jimmy, who was playing at Cornell previously. He's kind of he's bigger. He's, you know, than his brother Buddy, but he's made 46% of his threes so far this year. Pretty limited shot selection. He hasn't been a great 3-point shooter in the past. So I don't know how that's going to hold. But they're, you know, if you've watched Syracuse in the past, you know exactly what you're going to get. They're going to have a go gadget guy in the middle, you know, surrounded by the four other guys playing in the zone. And their defense, you know, to date has not been that good, despite the fact that they have three seniors and two juniors in the starting lineup. And they also have zero functional depth. You know, it's they basically play six guys, maybe seven guys. And so if it's, you know, reffed in any way that is beneficial to calling fouls, you know, Syracuse could get into some serious trouble. And, you know, I'm with you that I think, you know, home game, we don't lose in the Tuck. Hopefully it'll be a good crowd. I think that the Syracuse game is really winnable.
Well, and they're just not turning teams over. I'm not saying that the 2-3 zone was always a turnover creating machine, but they just don't quite have anyone that has that just like freakishly long length, maybe that is really, really exerting pressure on teams on the perimeter, or maybe they do, and they're just not being used. It, like you said, their defense has been exploitable this season. Can they get it turned around in the next week? I mean, yeah, we're six games into the season. A lot of teams are a work in progress right now. Maybe they figure something out in their home game against Indiana, but you know, Matt Cleveland seems like a guy that is just going to accept, like you get a guy like Matt Cleveland into the short corner or right in that center of the zone and let him shoot, pass, even guys like Mills that are able to break it down. As long as we don't start doing that thing where we're dribbling into where the zone wants you to dribble into, I think we're going to be okay. You know, Osborne can hit that short corner shot. Matt Cleveland can. We should be able to generate some transition offense after, I mean, they're not going to make every three. So after some long rebounds off missed threes, we should be able to transition. And really just wear them down. We've done that a lot in the Tucker Center. We've withstood some barrages of offensive displays from some NBA caliber guards and wings that Boeheim has brought down over the years. And we seem to just wear them down and find ways to execute in the last 10 minutes of the game. And I would expect the same thing in the Sun.
Yeah. And I think the big difference, you nailed it, is that in the past, Boeheim's had pros, you know, out on the court, and this year it's just, you know, I'm not seeing it there. The talent level is not that great. You know, when Buddy Boeheim is your best player, you know, that's probably not a good sign. And, you know, the rest of the guys are just, you know, they're solid players, but, you know, they all have big holes in their game. Like Gerard plays 35 minutes a game and he's 6'1". You know, it's really hard to run an effective zone when you have a guy 6'1" who's not, you know, Tony Douglas. So,
and you know, we've played against Gerard. Gerard played all 40 minutes in the game again in 2020, which, you know, arguably our best team of the Hamilton era. And that was a close game. That was 80-77. And you know, Florida State, you know, and what they had, Elijah Hughes, they had that NBA talent. He's playing with Forrest with the Jazz right now. Elijah Hughes came in 25 points, a couple of assists, few steals. He was rocking, off the dribble twos, and that opened up Gerard to make 5 of 12 threes, but he was 2 for 10 inside the arc because like you just said, he's 6'1". Name me a small guard in the last 5 years that has had, you know, a lot of success against Florida State. And it's, you know, he's listed at 6'1". It's probably half an inch shorter than that. That's not a great recipe for success in a 2-3 zone. And it's not a great recipe for success operating an offense against guys like Cameron Fletcher and Anthony Polite.
Yeah, when you can just pass right over the top of them, that's a problem. One, you know, interesting point is that, you know, you brought up the 2020 game, and that's the last time we played. I don't believe we played Syracuse last year. So
I think that was one of the games that got canceled, maybe.
Yeah. So any preparation that guys who were here last year would have gotten, you know, they you know, did not prepare for Syracuse last year. So it's going to be a little steeper of a learning curve. It might be one of those games where, you know, we really struggle early. Syracuse takes a lead, and then the second half, the coaches, you know, make some adjustments in halftime, and we come out and just blow them out.
So what you might take away, and we're not advocating anything on this show, and we certainly take no responsibility for bets gone sideways, but you might consider Syracuse in the first half to cover and Florida State to cover in the second half, if you were inclined to do so. All right. So it sounds like then I've got you down, Michael, for a blowout loss on the road to Purdue and a comeback win. Maybe you want to give me a number for the Syracuse game?
Yeah, I'll take 72-65.
Okay. I will agree with you on the Purdue game, and I'll say slightly higher scoring. I'll say that Buddy likes the friendly shooting line sight lines of Tuck, and we kind of torch that defense in the second half for 80-74 over Syracuse.
And the Purdue game, if we're the first team to hold them below 80 or the second team to hold them below 90, then I would consider that a success.
Imagine it's going to be 72, 73 possessions probably. And if that is the case, I would imagine that they are over 90. If you had to ask, if I was truthfully asking.
Probably a safe bet.
Yeah. So, all right. Well, it's been fun. Maybe we'll watch. Maybe, who knows? Maybe this is going to be the great 2-0 week and sort of the awakening of the 2020 two team, but either way, it's going to be fun, and we'll come back and talk about it next week.
Sounds good. It's good talking to you as always.
Yep.
And I look forward to something happening Tuesday night. Hopefully it's good.
Absolutely. For Michael, I'm Matt, signing off.